Thank you very much, and thank you for coming out on a cold and rainy evening to talk about this most important of topics with me, the absurdity of life without God. Our program this evening will consist of some dramatic readings to illustrate the question before us this evening. Then I'll speak for about 35 minutes or so on the topic, and then we're going to throw open the floor for discussion, for your questions and comments. And so as I speak, I want to encourage you to be thinking about these issues and to be contemplating what sort of question you might like to ask about this. But first, I want to invite you to imagine a world without God, a world in which only human beings exist in their tiny corner of the universe.
We are such stuff as dreams are made on, and our little life is rounded with a sleep.
April is the cruelest month, breeding lilacs out of the dead land, mixing memory and desire, stirring dull roots with spring rain. Winter kept us warm, covering earth in forgetful snow, feeding a little life with dried tubers. Summer surprised us, coming over the Strandberg Sea, and went on in sunlight into the castle garden, and drank coffee and talked for an hour. And when we were children, staying at the Archduke's, my cousin, he took me out on a sled, and I was frightened. He said, Marie, hold on tight. And down we went. In the mountains, there you feel free. I read much of the night and go south in the winter.
What are the roots that clutch? What branches grow out of this stony rubbish? Son of man, you cannot say or guess, for you know only a heap of broken images. Where the sun beats and the dead tree gives no shelter, the cricket no relief, and the dry stone no sound of water. Only there's a shadow under this red rock. Come to this shadow under this red rock, and I will show you something different from either your shadow in the morning striding behind you or your shadow in the evening rising to meet you. I will show you fear in a handful of dust. You gave me hyacinths first a year ago. They called me Hyacinth Girl, yet when we came back late from the hyacinth garden, your arms full, your hair wet, I could not speak and my eyes failed. I was neither living nor dead, and I knew nothing, looking into the heart of light, of silence.
That force that through the green fuse drives the flower, drives my green age, that blasts the roads of trees, is my destroyer, and I am dumb to tell the crooked rose my youth is bent by that same wintry fever. The force that drives the water through the rocks drives my red blood, that drives the mouthing streams, turns mine to wax. And I am dumb to mouth unto my veins how at the mountain spring the same mouth sucks. The hand that whirls the water in the pool stirs the quicksand, that ropes the blowing wind, hauls my shroud sail. And I am dumb to tell the hangman how of my clay is made the hangman's lime. The lips of time leech the fountainhead. Love drips and gathers, but the fallen blood shall calm her sores. And I am dumb to tell a weather's wind how time has ticked a heaven round the stars. And I am dumb to tell the lover's tomb how at my sheet goes the same crooked worm.
I am 14 and my skin has betrayed me. The boy I cannot live without still sucks his thumb in secret. How come my knees are always so ashy? What if I die before morning? Mom is in the bedroom with her door closed. I have to learn how to dance before the next party. My room is too small for me. Suppose I die before graduation. They'll sing sad melodies, but finally tell the truth about me. There's nothing I want to do, and too much that has to be done, and Mama's in the bedroom with her door closed. Nobody even stops to think about my side of it. I should have been on the math team. My marks were better than his. Why do I have to be the one wearing braces? I have nothing to wear tomorrow. Will I live long enough to grow up? And Mama's in the bedroom with the door closed.
After the torchlight red on sweaty faces, after the frosty silence in gardens and the agony in stony places, the shouting and the crying, prison and palace and reverberation, thunder, spring over distant mountains. He who is living is now dead, and we who are living are now dying with a little patience. Here is no water but only rock, rock and no water and sandy road, the road winding above among the mountains which are mountains of rock. Without water. If there were water, we should stop to drink. Amongst the rocks, one cannot stop or think. Sweat is dry and the feet are in the sand. If there were only water amongst the rocks, dead mountain mouth of carious teeth that cannot spit. Here one can neither stand, nor lie, nor sit. There is not even silence in the mountains, but dry, sterile thunder without rain. There is not even solitude in the mountains. But red, sullen faces sneer and snarl from the doors of mud-cracked houses. If there were water...
And no rock. If there were rock and also water. And water, a spring, a pool among the rock. If there were the sound of water only. Not the cicada and dry grass singing, but of water over a rock. Where the hermit thrush sings in the pine trees. Drip, drop, drip, drop, 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 drop. There is no water.
Who is the third who always walks beside you? When I count, there are only you and I together. But when I look ahead up the white road, there's always another walking beside you, gliding, wrapped in a brown mantle, hooded. I do not know whether a man nor a woman, but who is that on the other side of you? What is that sound high in the air, murmur of maternal lamentation? Who are those hooded hordes swarming over endless plains, stumbling in cracked earth, ringed by the flat horizon only? What is the city over the mountains? Cracks and reforms and bursts in the violet air, falling towers, Jerusalem, Athens, Alexandria, Vienna, London, unreal. We are such stuff as dreams are made on, and our little life is rounded with a little sleep.
Man, writes Lauren Isley, is the cosmic orphan. He's the only creature in the universe who asks why. Other animals have instincts to guide them, but man has learned to ask questions. Who am I? He asks. Why am I here? Where am I going? Well, ever since the Enlightenment, when modern man threw off the shackles of religion, he's tried to answer those questions without reference to God. But the answers that came back were not exhilarating, but dark and terrible. You are the accidental byproduct of nature, a result of matter plus time plus chance. There is no reason for your existence. All you face is death. Modern man thought that in throwing off God, he had freed himself from all that stifled and repressed him. Instead, he discovered that in killing God, he had only succeeded in orphaning himself. For if there is no God, then man's life becomes ultimately absurd. It is without ultimate meaning, without ultimate value, without ultimate purpose. I'd like to look at each one of these tonight. First, life is without ultimate meaning. If each individual person passes out of existence when he dies, then what ultimate meaning can be given to his life? Does it really matter whether he ever existed or not? Now, it might be said that his life was important because it influenced others or affected the course of history. But that shows only a relative significance to his life, not an ultimate significance. If all of the events are ultimately meaningless, then what significance is there in influencing any of them? Mankind is destined only to perish in the eventual heat death of the universe. And thus the contributions of the scientist to the advance of human knowledge, the efforts of the doctor to alleviate pain and suffering, the efforts of the diplomat to secure peace in the world, the sacrifices of good people everywhere to better the lot of the human race. In the end, all of these come to nothing. They don't make one bit of difference, not one bit. And therefore, each person's life is without ultimate significance. And because our lives are ultimately meaningless, the activities that we fill our lives with are also, in the final analysis, meaningless. The long hours spent in study at the university, our friendships, our interests, our jobs, our relationships, all of these are, in the final analysis, ultimately meaningless. This is the horror of modern man. Because he ends in nothing, he ultimately is nothing. 20th century man came to understand this. Read, for example, a play like Waiting for Godot by Samuel Beckett. During this entire play, two men carry on trivial, mind-numbing conversation while waiting for a third man to arrive who never does. And our lives are like that, Beckett is saying. We just kill time waiting for what? We don't know. In a tragic portrayal of man, Beckett wrote another play in which the curtain opened, revealing a stage littered with trash. And for 30 long seconds, the audience sat and stared in silence at that junk. And then the curtain closed. That was all. The French existentialists, Jean-Paul Sartre and Albert Camus, also understood this. Sartre portrayed life in his play, No Exit, as hell. The final line of the play are the words of resignation, well, let's get on with it. Hence, Sartre writes elsewhere of the nausea of existence. Man, he says, is adrift in a boat without a rudder on an endless sea. Camus also saw life as absurd. Life, he said, is like a man doomed for all eternity to roll a boulder up a hill only to have it continually roll back down again, over and over and over again. At the end of his brief novel, The Stranger, Camus' hero discovers in a flash of insight that life has no meaning and that there is no God to give it one. The French biochemist Jacques Monod seemed to echo these sentiments when he wrote in his work, Chance and Necessity, man finally knows that he is alone in the indifferent immensity of the universe. Thus, if there is no God, then life itself becomes ultimately meaningless. Man and the universe are without ultimate significance. Second, life is without ultimate value. If life ends at the grave, then it ultimately makes no difference whether you've lived as a Stalin or as a saint. As the Russian writer Fyodor Dostoevsky put it, if there is no immortality, then all things are permitted. On this basis, a writer like Ayn Rand is absolutely correct to praise the virtues of selfishness. Live totally for self. No one holds you accountable. Indeed, it would be foolish to do anything else, for life is too short to jeopardize it by acting out of anything but pure self-interest. Sacrifice for another person would be stupid. But the problem becomes even worse. For regardless of immortality, if there is no God, then there is no absolute standard of right and wrong. All we're confronted with is, in Jean-Paul Sartre's words, the bare, valueless fact of existence. Moral values are either just the socio-cultural byproducts of the evolutionary process, or else mere expressions of personal taste. In a world without God, who's to say whose values are right and whose are wrong? Who's to judge that the values of an Adolf Hitler are inferior to those of a Mother Teresa? The concept of objective morality loses all meaning in a universe without God. There can be no right and wrong. But that means that it's impossible to condemn war, oppression, brutality, or crime as evil. By the same token, one cannot praise brotherhood, equality, love, or self-sacrifice as good. For in a universe without God, good and evil do not exist. There is just the bare, valueless fact of existence. And there's no one to say that you are right and I am wrong. And thirdly, life is ultimately without purpose. If death stands with open arms at the end of life's trail, then to what end has life been? Is it all for nothing? Is there no reason for life? Is there no purpose at all for the human race? Or will it simply peter out someday, lost somewhere in the oblivion of an indifferent universe? The English writer H.G. Wells foresaw such a prospect. In his novel, The Time Machine, Wells' time traveler journeys far into the distant future to discover the eventual destiny of man. And all he finds is a dead earth, except for a few lichens and moss, orbiting a gigantic red sun. The only sounds are the rush of the wind and the gentle ripple of the sea. Beyond these lifeless sounds, writes Wells, the world was silent. Silent? It would be hard to convey the stillness of it. All the sounds of man, the bleating of sheep, the cries of birds, the hum of insects, the stir that makes the background of our lives, all that was over. And so Wells' time traveler returned. But to what? To merely an earlier point on the same purposeless rush towards oblivion. When, as a non-Christian, I first read Wells' book, I thought, no, it can't end this way. But this is reality in a universe without God. If there is no God, then it will end that way, like it or not. There is no hope. There is no purpose. I'm reminded of T.S. Eliot's haunting lines, "This is the way the world ends. This is the way the world ends. This is the way the world ends. Not with a bang, but a whimper." If there is no God, then our lives are not qualitatively different from that of a dog. Now, I know that sounds harsh, but it's true. As the ancient writer of the book of Ecclesiastes put it, "The fate of the sons of men and the fate of beasts is the same. As one dies, so dies the other. They all have the same breath, and man has no advantage over the beasts, for all is vanity. All go to one place. All are from the dust, and all turn to dust again." In this book, which reads more like a piece of modern existentialist literature than a book from the Bible, the author shows the futility of pleasure, wealth, education, political fame, and honor in a life doomed to end in death. His verdict? Vanity of vanities. All is vanity. If life ends at the grave, then we have no ultimate purpose for living. So I hope you begin to grasp the gravity of the alternatives before us. For if God does not exist, then all we are left with is despair. Life would have no significance, no value, no purpose. And that is why the question of the existence of God is so vital to mankind.
Unfortunately, most people do not seem to realize this fact, and therefore they go blithely on their way as though nothing had changed. I'm reminded of the story told by Friedrich Nietzsche, the great atheist of the 19th century, who proclaimed the death of God. Nietzsche tells the story of a madman who, in the early morning hours, burst into the marketplace, lantern in hand, crying, "I seek God! I seek God!" And since many of those standing about didn't believe in God, he provoked much laughter. "Maybe God has gone on a voyage or emigrated," they laughed. And so they taunted him and mocked him. And then, writes Nietzsche, the madman turned in their midst and pierced them with his eyes. "Whither is God?" he cried. "I shall tell you. We have killed him, you and I. All of us are his murderers. But how have we done this? How were we able to drink up the sea? Who gave us the sponge to wipe away the entire horizon? What did we do when we unchained this earth from its sun? Whither is it moving now, away from all suns? Are we not plunging continually, backward, sideward, forward, in all directions? Is there any up or down left? Are we not straying as through an infinite nothing? Do we not feel the breath of empty space? Has not become colder? Is not night and more night coming on all the while? Must not lanterns be lit in the morning? Do we not hear anything yet of the noise of the grave diggers who are burying God? God is dead, and we have killed him. How shall we, the murderers of all murderers, comfort ourselves?" The crowd stared at the madman in silence and astonishment, and at last he smashed his lantern to the ground. "I have come too early," he said. "This tremendous event is still on its way. It has not yet reached the ears of men." You see, men did not truly comprehend what they had done in killing God. But Nietzsche predicted that someday people would realize the consequences of atheism. And this realization would usher in an age of nihilism. That is to say, the destruction of all meaning and value in life. "The end of Christianity," wrote Nietzsche, "means the advent of nihilism. This most gruesome of guests is standing already at the door. Our whole European culture is moving for some time now," wrote Nietzsche, "with a tortured tension that is growing from decade to decade as toward a catastrophe, restlessly, violently, headlong, like a river that wants to reach its end, that no longer reflects, that is afraid to reflect." Most people still do not reflect upon the consequences of secular atheism, and therefore, like the crowd in the marketplace, go unknowingly on their way. But when we realize, as Nietzsche did, the consequences of what atheism implies, and when we stare atheism unflinchingly in the face, as Nietzsche had the courage to do, then his question presses hard upon us. How shall we, the murderers of all murderers, comfort ourselves? Well, it seems to me that confronted with this predicament, we have basically three alternatives. Number one, commit suicide. Faced with the absurdity of life, one should simply end it now. Camus considered suicide to be the only serious philosophical question. Is it worth it to go on living? And sometimes we hear of people who answer no. In the United States, the leading cause of death among teenagers today is suicide. But for most of us, suicide is not the answer. The pleasures that life does afford and the fear of the unknown compel us to go on living. The second alternative is to face the absurdity of life and to live bravely. Atheist philosopher Bertrand Russell said, for example, that only upon the firm foundation of unyielding despair can the soul's habitation be henceforth safely built. Camus said that we should simply recognize the absurdity of life and then live in love for one another. But the problem with this alternative is that it is impossible to live consistently and happily within the framework of such a worldview. Man cannot live as though life had no meaning, value, and purpose. And so what people subconsciously do is to assume that their lives have meaning, value, and purpose, even though they have no right to, since modern man does not believe in God. And what I'd like to do is to look again at each of those three areas in which we saw that life is absurd without God, and to show how modern man fails to live consistently and happily within this worldview. First, the area of meaning. We saw that without God, life is ultimately meaningless. And yet philosophers continue to live as though life does have meaning. For example, Jean-Paul Sartre argued that one may create meaning for his life by freely choosing some course of action. Sartre himself chose Marxism. Now, this program is utterly inconsistent. It is inconsistent to say on the one hand that life is absurd, and then to say on the other hand that one may create meaning for his life. For if life is objectively absurd, then man is trapped. Without God, there can be no objective meaning in life. Sartre's program is actually an exercise in self-delusion. For the universe doesn't really acquire a meaning just because I happen to give it one. And I think this is obvious. For suppose you give the universe one meaning and I give it another. Who's right? Well, I think the obvious answer is neither one. For the universe in and of itself remains intrinsically meaningless, regardless of how we happen to regard it. Sartre is really saying, let's pretend that the universe has meaning. And this is just fooling yourself. The point is this: if God does not exist, then life is objectively meaningless. But mankind cannot live consistently and happily as though life were meaningless. And so in order to be happy, he invents certain purposes and projects for life, and he pretends that these invest his life with meaning. But this is, of course, entirely inconsistent, for without God, man and the universe are ultimately without significance. Turn next to the problem of value. This is where the most blatant inconsistencies occur. First of all, atheistic humanists are totally inconsistent in holding to the values of human love and brotherhood. Camus has been rightly criticized for inconsistently holding to the absurdity of life on the one hand and to the ethics of human love and brotherhood on the other. The two are logically incompatible. As one philosopher has written, it is impossible to generate an ethic of brotherly love out of a philosophy of nihilism. Bertrand Russell, too, was inconsistent. For although he was an atheist, Russell was also an outspoken social critic, denouncing war and restrictions on sexual freedom. Russell admitted that he could not live as though moral values were simply the subjective expressions of personal taste, and that he therefore found his own views, and I quote, incredible. I do not know the solution, he confessed. The point is that if there is no God, then absolute right and wrong do not exist. As Dostoevsky said, all things are permitted. But Dostoevsky also showed that man cannot live this way. He shows this, for example, in his novel Crime and Punishment, in which a young atheist brutally murders an old woman, though he knows that on his presuppositions he should not feel guilty. Nevertheless, he is consumed with guilt until he finally confesses his crime and gives his life to God. In his masterpiece, The Brothers Karamazov, Dostoevsky tells of how a man murders his father because his brother, Ivan, had told him that God does not exist, and therefore there are no moral absolutes. The man tells Ivan that it was really Ivan himself who murdered their father, since it was Ivan who said that moral absolutes are illusory. Unable to live with the logical consequences of his own system, Ivan suffers a mental collapse. Man cannot live as though moral values do not exist. He cannot live as though it's perfectly all right for soldiers to slaughter innocent children. He cannot live as though it's all right for dictatorial regimes to follow systematic programs of physical torture of political prisoners. He cannot live as though it's perfectly all right for dictators like Pol Pot or Slobodan Milosevic to ruthlessly commit ethnic cleansing and genocide against their own people. Everything in him cries out to say that these acts are wrong, really wrong. But if God does not exist, he cannot. And therefore, he makes a leap of faith and affirms values anyway. And when he does so, he reveals the inadequacy of a world without God. The horror of an atheistic universe was brought home to me powerfully a few years ago through a BBC television documentary called The Gathering. It featured interviews with survivors of the Holocaust who had regathered in Jerusalem to share their experiences and rediscover lost friendships. Now, I had visited concentration camps in Europe and had heard stories of the Holocaust before, and I thought I was beyond shocking by further tales of horror. But as I viewed these interviews, I found that I was not. One woman, for example, told of how she was incarcerated at Auschwitz and was forced, because she was a nurse, to become the gynecologist at Auschwitz. She noticed that Dr. Mengele housed all of the pregnant women together in a certain barracks, and some time passed and she no longer saw any of these women. She made inquiries. What happened to the women who were housed in that barracks? Oh, haven't you heard? Came the reply. Dr. Mengele used them for vivisection. A rabbi told the story of a woman at the camp who had a small infant. Dr. Mengele wanted to conduct experiments to see how long an infant could survive without nourishment. And so he had this woman's breasts bound up so that she couldn't suckle her baby. And every day the baby lost weight, which was eagerly monitored by Dr. Mengele. Desperately, this poor woman tried to keep the baby alive by feeding it bits of bread soaked in coffee, but all to no avail. Every day the baby lost weight, and each day Dr. Mengele weighed the baby to check its decline. Then a nurse came secretly to this woman and said, I've brought a morphine injection for you to kill your baby, and you can get out of this place. I've arranged a way of escape for you, but you can't bring the baby with you. The woman protested. I can't kill my own child. She said, look, the baby is going to die anyway. At least save yourself. And so this mother felt compelled to take the life of her own infant. My heart was torn as I heard these stories. The rabbi at Auschwitz said that it was as though there existed a world in which all of the Ten Commandments were reversed. Thou shalt lie. Thou shalt kill. Thou shalt steal. Mankind has never seen such a hell. And yet, in a real sense, if God does not exist, then our world is Auschwitz. There is no ultimate right and wrong. All things are permitted. But no atheist, no agnostic can live consistently and happily within the framework of such a worldview. Finally, let's look at the problem of purpose in life. The only way that most people who deny purpose in life manage to live happily is either by making up some purpose for their life, which amounts to self-delusion, as we saw with Sartre, or else by not carrying out their views to its logical conclusions. For example, take the problem of death. According to the psychologist Ernst Bloch, the only way modern man lives in the face of death is by subconsciously borrowing the belief in immortality which his forefathers held to, even though he himself has no basis for this belief, since he does not believe in God. Bloch concludes, thus this quite shallow courage feasts on a borrowed credit card. It lives from earlier hopes and the support they had once provided. But modern man no longer has any right to that support, since he rejects God. But in order to live purposefully in the face of death, he makes a leap of faith to affirm a reason for living. We often find the same inconsistency among those who say that man and the universe came to exist for no purpose, but just by chance. For example, feminists have raised a storm of protest over Freudian sexual psychology because they say it's chauvinistic and degrading to women. And some psychologists knuckled under and revised their theories. Now, this is totally inconsistent. If Freudian psychology is really true, then it doesn't matter if it's degrading to women. You can't change the truth because you don't like what it leads to. But people cannot live consistently and happily in a world in which other people are devalued. But if God does not exist, then nobody has any value. Only if God exists can one consistently support women's rights. For if God does not exist, then natural selection dictates that the male of the species is the dominant and aggressive one. Women would have no more rights than a female goat or a chicken has rights. In nature, whatever is right. But who can live with such a view? Apparently not even Freudian psychologists, who revise their theories when pushed to their logical conclusions. Or take the sociological behaviorism of a man like B.F. Skinner. This view leads to the sort of society envisioned by George Orwell in 1984, where the government controls and programs the thought of everybody. If Pavlov's dog can be made to salivate when a bell rings, then so can a human being. And if Skinner's theories are right, there can be no moral objection to treating people like the rats in Skinner's rat box as they run through their mazes, coaxed on by food and electric shocks. According to Skinner, all of our actions are programmed anyway. And if God does not exist, then no moral objection can be raised against this kind of programming. For man is not qualitatively different from a rat, for both are just the result of matter plus time plus chance. But again, who can live with such a dehumanizing worldview? Or finally, take the biological determinism of a man like Francis Crick. The logical conclusion is that man is like any other laboratory specimen. The world was horrified when it learned that at camps like Dachau, the Nazis had used prisoners for medical experiments on human beings. But why not? If God does not exist, there can be no objection to using people as human guinea pigs. A memorial at Dachau says, "Nie wieder," never again. But this sort of thing continued to go on. It was recently revealed that in the United States after the war, various persons of minority group status were injected, unknown to them, with a sterilization drug by medical researchers. Mustn't we protest that this is wrong? That people are more than just electrochemical machines? The end of this view is population control, in which the weak and the unwanted are killed off to make room for the strong. But the only way we can consistently protest this view is if God exists. Only if God exists can there be purpose in life. And thus, as one modern writer has said, if God is dead, man is dead too. Man cannot live consistently and happily as though life were without meaning, value, and purpose. The finite world alone is insufficient to maintain a happy and consistent life. But that throws us on to the third and final alternative. And this is to challenge the worldview of modern man, to maintain that God does exist and that life does have meaning, value, and purpose. This is the position of biblical Christianity. Biblical Christianity thus provides the solution to the predicament of modern man. For according to the Christian worldview, God does exist, and life does not end at the grave. And therefore, biblical Christianity provides the two necessary prerequisites for a happy and consistent life: God and immortality. According to the Christian worldview, life does have meaning because mankind is made in the personal image of God. And our destiny is to know God and enjoy Him and His love forever. Life has value because God's own holy and righteous nature is the absolute standard of right and wrong, good and evil. And that nature is expressed toward us in the form of His divine commandments, which constitute for us our moral duties. And thus the moral choices we make now in this life are filled with an eternal significance. Finally, life has purpose. As the Westminster Catechism says, the end of man is to glorify God and to enjoy Him forever. And thus, biblical Christianity succeeds precisely where atheism breaks down. The cosmic orphan can come home. Now, I want to make it clear that none of this tonight proves that biblical Christianity is true. But I think that it does clearly spell out the alternatives before us. If God does not exist, then life is futile. If the God of the Bible does exist, then life is meaningful. Only the second of these two alternatives enables us to live a happy and consistent life. And therefore, it seems to me that even if the evidence for and against these two alternatives were absolutely equal, that the rational thing to do is to believe in God. That is to say, it seems to me that if the evidence is equal, that it is positively irrational to prefer death, futility, and destruction to life, meaningfulness, and happiness. As Pascal has written, we have nothing to lose and infinity to gain. Well, now at this time, we're going to throw it open for your questions and discussion, and Ethan is going to assist us, I think, in doing that. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Craig. Do we have our wireless mics out in the house? George is upstairs. Okay. Who would like to be first? Right there, right by George.
Could you address the issue of different religions and different gods?
Yes. What I've said tonight pertains to the Christian world and life view, but it wouldn't be exclusively Christian. In the sense that any view of the world that gives you those two necessary prerequisites, a personal God who can be known and loved and experienced, and immortality. So this would be consistent with Judaism, for example, and perhaps Islam as well. It would not be consistent with certain Eastern religions, which deny that there is any sort of personal God. And, in fact, usually deny immortality. The goal is often self-extinction. The self is obliterated. So that those would not meet, I think, the predicament of modern man. But at least the three great monotheistic faiths that are in the Judeo-Christian tradition would provide the necessary prerequisites, I think, for an objectively meaningful and purposeful existence.
You talked a little while ago about how without a God we can't have something like women's rights when you were talking about Freud. Where do animal rights fit into this?
That's a very, very interesting question. I hope you want to know, where does animal rights fit into all of this? I again, would say the same thing about animal rights. It seems to me that in the absence of God, I can't understand how in the world any person could support animal rights. Because in nature, as I say, whatever is right. The law of the jungle rules. The only law in nature is survival of the fittest. And if the species of Homo sapiens should decide to exterminate all of the other life forms on the earth, there is no right or wrong in that. That's just the law of survival of the fittest. So it seems to me that, again, only the theist, only the person who believes in God, is well posed to defend conservation efforts and efforts to preserve endangered species and to have an adequate environmental ethic. I cannot understand how an atheist or a naturalist can have an environmental ethic. Now, having said that, I don't think that I would construe it, however, in terms of animal rights per se, because I don't think that animals are moral agents. Persons are moral agents, and animals aren't persons. So, for example, when a lion kills a zebra, it kills it, but it doesn't murder it. Or when a seagull snatches a fish out of the talons of another seagull, it takes the fish, but it doesn't steal the fish, if you understand what I mean. Animals don't have moral duties or obligations. So I wouldn't construe an animal or environmental ethic in terms of animal rights. Rather, I would construe it in terms of human responsibilities and human moral duties. That is to say, God, according to the creation narrative in the Bible, has given man charge to steward the earth, to care for the earth, and to husband it as a gardener would care for a vineyard, say. And therefore, to rape and plunder the earth and its resources and its animals is a violation of God's command for us to steward and care for his creation. And I think that God is wounded, so to speak, when he sees the terrible blight that mankind has often wrought upon the beautiful nature that God created, which in Genesis it says God saw that it was very good. And we often haven't lived up to that creation mandate. So I wouldn't see it in terms of animal rights per se, but rather in terms of human moral duties to care for these beautiful creations that God has made and provided us.
Anyone upstairs? Over there on the other side.
Maybe take one down here in the meantime.
Yeah, okay, we'll take this one first, and then we'll go upstairs for two over on that side.
Yeah, Mr. Craig, you said that that the three great religions, monotheistic religions, Judaism, Islam, and Christianity, all would be consistent with a worldview that acknowledged a God and gave meaning and purpose. And I agree with that, but here's my question. Why did you choose to become a Christian as opposed to a Muslim or a Jew? What do you find different about Christianity that you find more fulfilling for yourself, or more do you find answers those questions of purpose and value and meaning? What do you find different about Christianity that you find the answers to be more more fulfilling or more enriching than the other two religions you mentioned?
Well, I think you won't be surprised if I answer Jesus of Nazareth. He was the difference, and he is what distinguishes Judaism and Islam from Christianity, among other things. When, as a non-Christian, I first heard the message of Christ, I began to read the New Testament. I had never read a New Testament before, and as I read the Gospels and the story of Jesus of Nazareth, I was absolutely captivated by this person. His words had the ring of truth about them. There was a wisdom there that I had never encountered before, and his life had an authenticity about it that wasn't characteristic of many people who claim to be his followers in our culture, who claim to be Christians. And I was just captivated by Jesus of Nazareth. And when I understood the message of the New Testament, that I was sinful and therefore separated from God, that rang true in my life. I sensed that though I believed there was a God out there who existed, that I enjoyed no personal relationship with him. He was a distant and unknown entity to me. And I, as I looked into my own heart, I could see the blackness within, the moral selfishness and self-centeredness. And so I had no problem with what I read in the New Testament when it said that all people are sinful and fall short of the glory of God. I understood the love of Christ, And that drew me, the notion that God himself, in the form of his Son, would die on the cross as a sacrifice for my sin so that I could be reconciled to him. And then most of all, perhaps, the notion that through Christ I could come into a personal relationship with God, that God could become a living personal reality in my life as a loving Father. This was tremendously appealing. And so as I read the New Testament and read Christian books and so forth over about a period of about 6 months, I was just convinced that it was true. And since then, nothing that I've read or studied has changed my mind about that. When I look, for example, at Judaism, I think that the Old Testament looks forward to Jesus as the Jewish Messiah. I think believing in Jesus is the most Jewish thing a person can do. When I read the Quran, I find that the portrait of Jesus in the Quran, I think, is historically inaccurate. That it is written 600 years after the events and is demonstrably legendary in many respects, whereas the documents of the New Testament were written in the first generation while the eyewitnesses were still alive, and thus give a more accurate portrayal of who the historical Jesus was. And so for those reasons, I think that the Christian claim to be true is accurate, and therefore I count myself enthusiastically a Christian.